is VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Pete Musto.
There seems to be many choices for students in Africa to continue studying while schools remain closed because of the coronavirus crisis. Lessons are taught on television or over the radio. Math problems appear in newspapers. Classes are held on video conferencing services like Zoom or WhatsApp. But the truth is that many students will fall behind and possibly drop out of school forever. If that happens, inequality will worsen across an already unequal continent. Mary Goretti Nakabugo is a literacy expert who runs a nonprofit education organization called Uwezo. It is based in Uganda. Nakabugo told the Associated Press, "I think education now is more of an emergency than the health issue." Children, she added, are completely helpless at the moment. Nakabugo said that limited testing for COVID-19 means cases are likely undercounted in the East African country. But there have been no reported virus deaths in Uganda and just over 1,000 cases. The coronavirus crisis has created education difficulties around the world. But the schooling crisis is even more severe in Africa, where up to 80% of schools are unable to connect to the internet. Electricity is also sometimes not dependable, making distance learning difficult or even impossible. And in normal times, schools often provide safety to children and offer services that their families cannot pay for. Sub-Saharan Africa has more children who do not attend school than any other place in the world. The United Nations Culture and Education Agency reports nearly one-fifth of children between the ages of 6 and 11 and over one-third of youth between 12 and 14 do not attend school. In a report published this week, the charity organization Save the Children called the coronavirus crisis the biggest global education emergency of our time. The report identified 12 countries in which children are at extremely high risk of dropping out forever. 9 of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. With the help of outside groups, some African governments have announced measures to support learning from home. But many have been limited by a lack of dependable electricity and poor internet connectivity. Even publishing lessons in newspapers can be too costly for people in some places. Uganda's government has promised to provide 10 million radios and over 130,000 solar-powered television sets. But officials have failed to honor other promises during the crisis, including giving free face coverings to everyone. In neighboring Kenya, schools for young children and teenagers will remain closed through 2020. Yet colleges and universities can reopen in September. The decision means Kenyan students will repeat a school year, a situation commonly described as a dead year. The effects of school closures will not be limited to learning. A report by the Norway-based Christian Michelsen Institute said the critical consequences may be related to health, water, and nutrition. That is because schools provide important services to many African young people, the Development Research Organization noted. School closures may deny students access to food and health programs, and sometimes clean water. Schools also provide protection for children from work and exploitation. Girls may especially suffer, says literacy expert Nakabugo. She noted several studies that have reported a rise in pregnancies among teenagers. The Norway-based group's report noted that the same thing happened during West Africa's Ebola crisis. The shutdown could also mean many schools close permanently and many teachers quit, worsening what is already the world's worst teacher shortage. Media reports in Uganda point to school owners who are looking to sell their properties or have turned student housing into apartments in order to pay their loans. In the West African nation of Senegal, education officials tried to keep children learning by broadcasting some classes on television after schools closed in March. I'm Pete Musto.
Most theaters in America may be closed, but one musical theater show is not letting that stop it from preparing. K-pop is a musical exploring the world of Korean pop music. The producers are doing a video-based casting call worldwide in hopes of being ready when live performances restart. Jason Kim is the playwright or writer of the musical. We really hope as soon as possible to get into a room with all these people and see them in person, he told the Associated Press. Producers are looking for Korean, Korean American, and Asian American men and women in their 20s. They must be excellent singers with a strong pop sound, and great dancers. Knowing K-pop music is, of course, helpful. Claire Burke is a casting director at Tara Rubin Casting in New York. She said she and her team have a very tall ask. They are looking for performers who have all the energy and lovability of pop stars and also serious acting skills. It's about the shine and the performance and the dancing and the singing. That's huge, she said. But people also need to be able to really feel the emotion of it. Those who hope to be in the musical are asked to send a video of themselves singing a pop or K-pop song and a video of their dance moves. Submissions have so far come from the United States, South Korea, Britain, Canada, Japan, and Kazakhstan, and other countries. When K-pop returns, it will represent a rare thing. a live theater production with a nearly all Asian cast. The last time New York City had anything like that was in 2015 with Allegiance. It was a musical based on American actor George Takei's life in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. Kim said he strongly believes the right performers are out there and have been for a really long time. K-pop, which had its first showing in New York City in 2017, follows the lives of three sets of performers. It follows a boy band, a girl band, and a young woman singer as they try to gain success in the American music market. Theater critics have had great things to say about K-pop. In the original musical, crowds followed different performers from room to room. Kim is rewriting it for a more traditional theater setting, and songwriter Helen Park is adding new songs. The show is changing, just as K-pop music is. In the years since it began, Americans have learned more about the music, including such groups as BTS, EXO, and Blackpink. K-pop fans have also spoken online about everything from Black Lives Matter to Donald Trump. Kim has been helping the casting people go through hundreds of submissions to cast for 12 performers. Candidates who the team likes are sent material from the show to record and submit. The next step is a live video meeting with the creative team. Then, if chosen, candidates receive a message that they will see everyone at rehearsals, whenever that happens. Burke's team is showing understanding about the quality of submissions because of the coronavirus crisis. The usual process has candidates in a room together learning dance moves at the same time. It also has a trained actor as an audition reader, along with a person who knows the music. None of that is happening for the online process. Instead, the K-pop team has to deal with poor home microphones, bad lighting, and the real chance that a candidate's mother or sister is holding the cellular phone to record. I'm Alice Bryant.
A few years ago, on the American television show Saturday Night Live, actor Jerry Seinfeld answered questions from the audience. However, the people who asked them were not ordinary showgoers, but Hollywood stars. The questions were jokes that made fun of other actors. Tim Meadows asked if he could read from a magazine list of the worst actors to ever appear on the show.
But let me just read who's dead last. And do we have a camera ready to cut to Robert Downey Jr.?
No, let's not do this. Let's not do this. This is not a good idea. Right. Other questions?
Yeah.
Bob Odenkirk is here. Bob.
Thank you. Jerry, when are we doing a tribute to the writers of SNL?
That short discussion provides examples of two of the most common kinds of questions in English: yes-no questions and WH questions. A yes-no question is one that can be answered simply with a yes or a no.
And do we have a camera ready to cut to Robert Downey Jr.?
No, let's not do this.
The WH question requires a more detailed answer.
Gary, when are we doing a tribute to the writers of SNL?
That question includes the word when, which starts with WH. The words what, where, or why are also used for WH questions. This is where the WH name comes from. WH questions follow a pattern. The question word comes first, then come the subject and main verb. In some cases, there is a helping verb, such as do, have, or can, in between the question word and the subject. The pattern is question word plus helping verb plus subject plus main verb. Here are two examples, one in the present and one in the past.
Where does he work? What did she say?
You might be thinking that this is all you need to know about question words. But question words are important for another reason. They can be used in answers. Question words often begin noun clauses, groups of words with a subject and a verb. These clauses act like a noun in the sentence. Think back to our examples.
Where does he work? What did she say?
In response to these questions, a person might say,
I don't know where he works. I didn't hear what she said.
In the first example, where he works is a noun clause. In the second example, what she said is a noun clause. Notice that the question word order is not used in the answer. The verb do does not appear in the noun clause in the answer.
Where does he work? I don't know where he works.
The next time you are listening or reading, try to find examples of question words, both in questions and in answers. Also, pay attention to how speakers use intonation and word stress with question words. Then practice using them a lot. There are only a small number of question words, and they are useful in almost any situation you can think of. If your goal is to improve your speaking skills, then you must use question words with ease. I'm John Russell.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Calvin Coolidge. He was the vice president under Warren Harding. When Harding died suddenly, a little more than 2 years into his term, Coolidge became president. Coolidge is linked to two opposing ideas. The first idea is quiet restraint. The president's nickname was Silent Cal. He rarely took part in casual conversation. And as a leader, he often thought the best action was not to take any action. Many voters liked his cool style. Coolidge quickly earned a public image as a serious man who did not spend money or words easily. But Coolidge is also linked to a period in U.S. history known as the Roaring Twenties. In those years, the 1920s, the American economy was generally good. Many people spent money on exciting things, such as the still new automobile, and on entertainment, including alcoholic drinks, cigarettes, and dancing. Creative expression such as jazz and Art Deco architecture became popular. Calvin Coolidge is often given credit for helping fuel the Roaring Twenties with his pro-business economic policies. But some historians caution against remembering Coolidge's business freedom policies too fondly. They say he helped create the conditions for the severe economic depression that followed his presidency. Calvin Coolidge and his sister were born and raised on a farm in the northeast state of Vermont. Coolidge spoke highly of both his parents. His father owned a store and also held local political offices. He had a public image for honesty, public service, and thrift. Young Calvin Coolidge helped his father in the store and hoped to be just like him. Coolidge also admired his mother's strong character. He was 12 years old when she died, and he wrote that losing her was the greatest grief that can come to a boy. 6 years later, his sister also died. Their deaths made young Calvin Coolidge even more serious than he already was. But Coolidge was also known for his wit, a kind of humor that often depends on wordplay or intelligence. As a student at Amherst College in Massachusetts, Coolidge became known as an able and funny public speaker. That skill helped him rise in politics. He began with lower-level offices in Massachusetts and later served as that state's governor. Along the way, he married Grace Anna Goodhue, a teacher for the deaf. She was known to be warm and social, and the couple were reported to have a loving marriage. They went on to have two sons. In 1920, the Republican Party nominated Coolidge to be its vice presidential candidate. In general, voters liked the Republican ticket. They were ready for a change after the reform policies and international engagement of Democrat Woodrow Wilson. Sure enough, the Republicans won the election in a landslide. But Coolidge did not enjoy the office of vice president very much. He had little power in the government. During meetings, he often remained silent. One summer night, he and his wife were on vacation in Vermont. His father, Colonel Coolidge, woke them up in the middle of the night with some dramatic news. President Harding had died. Reporters quickly gathered at the small farmhouse. Colonel Coolidge had not put electricity in the house, so everyone watched by the light of an oil lamp. Colonel Coolidge was a public official. He used the family Bible and a copy of the Constitution to swear in his son as the 30th U.S. president. Then the country's new leader did a very sensible thing. He went back to bed. President Coolidge believed in limited government, especially limited federal government. He permitted state and cabinet officials to decide as many issues as they could. Coolidge used his authority to focus mostly on the country's economy. At the time he took office, the U.S. was at the start of an economic boom. Coolidge tried to maintain that prosperity. He did not regulate businesses too much, and he sharply reduced taxes, especially on the wealthy. By nearly every measure, the economy grew. But the policies also widened the divide between rich and poor Americans and put the country's economy in a risky situation. More and more people began to invest their money in the stock market. Some put their dollars in dangerous investments. And business owners produced more goods than most members of the public could really afford. Increasingly, people borrowed money on credit to pay for luxury goods. At the same time, the economic situation of many American farmers was getting worse. The weather had been unusually dry in some places, and the price of food was falling. Farmers asked the federal government for assistance. But Coolidge rejected several bills that might have helped them. The bills had other problems, Coolidge reasoned, and he did not think that the federal government should intervene in the situation. So the farmers continued to suffer. But most voters remained supportive of Coolidge. Even though the president was considered a quiet person, he spoke often on the radio, appeared in a talking film, met with reporters regularly, and posed in funny costumes for photographers. He easily won election in 1924. Historians believe he could have won another term, too, in 1928. But Coolidge chose not to seek office. Some believed he was too saddened by the death of his teenaged son. Shortly after Coolidge became president, the boy had been playing tennis and slightly wounded his toe. The wound became infected. The infection spread to the boy's blood. A few days later, he died. Although Coolidge continued his presidency, he later said the joy had gone from the job. But when he decided not to seek re-election, he did not talk about his feelings. Instead, he simply wrote a note to reporters saying, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928. His Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, was elected instead. Coolidge retired to his home in Massachusetts and led a quiet private life. President Coolidge was well-liked by most Americans. Later presidents, including Ronald Reagan, sought to follow some of his economic policies. But many historians have questioned those policies. They say that Coolidge did not pay enough attention to the situation of farmers. And they say the stock market was rising too fast. 7 months after Coolidge left office, the U.S. economy collapsed. The country was still deep in the Great Depression when Coolidge passed away. He died, quietly, of course, during an afternoon nap at the age of 60. His will was but a single sentence. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.